Stratus Foods is the industry partner you can depend on when you're looking for the very best in fats and oils. Our team of expert researchers, developers, and innovators have helped countless businesses just like yours bring their most delicious menus to life. With products that are reliable, sustainable, and ready to meet any challenge, you can fry, bake, saute, and grill with confidence. Stratus Foods, we've got you covered. Hi, and welcome to Extra Serving, an award-winning podcast by Nation's Restaurant News. I'm your host, Holly Petrie. Today on the pod, we're going to be talking about nostalgia's comeuppance at restaurants, menu price increases, and the results of our Consumer Reports survey. On Takeaway with Sam Okus, Sam talked with Ben Jacobs of Takabe. They spoke about what it's like to have a supply chain of all native people and foods. And be sure to check out First Bite, our daily morning podcast where I discuss the top news of the day alongside an NRN editor. And now it's time to introduce my co-hosts.
I am Sam Okus, Editor-in-Chief of Nation's Restaurant News.
And I am Leanne Zitzmeister, Managing Editor of NRN.
Welcome to the podcast, guys. Happy Friday.
Happy Friday, indeed.
Happy Friday.
They're going to get a more sassy version of us this week since it's Friday.
Yeah, we're recording on Friday instead of Thursday. So we got our sassy selves out for you guys this week.
We apologize in advance.
Do we? I make no apologies.
You know, it's afternoon. We could have actually had some drinks on this one if we really wanted to.
Oh, shoot.
Yeah.
Give me 2 seconds. I'll go get a drink.
Seriously. Are we doing this?
I'm upstairs. Too lazy.
Are we doing this?
Can you have one of your tiny humans fetch one for you?
Yeah. I mean, that's why I had children. Yeah. But they're all gone right now. So... not in the house at the moment.
Interesting. Oh,
so can you have your dog fetch one for you?
No, my dog is way too old, senile, and dumb to do that.
That's a real shame. You should get a dog that can fetch you alcohol.
Yes, that will be the next dog. Yes, the first thing I train that dog to do.
Man, it's a party thing.
I've seen it on the internet before.
That dogs will do that.
Well, that sure. Dogs will do that.
Dogs are incredibly smart, but... only if you train them to do that, you know? Like, I was a terrible dog owner when I got our dog because I was lazy, as has been established already. And I didn't train her very well. So now I have a very lazy, not well-trained dog. So.
Who shakes on podcasts.
She does. She might yet shake on this one because she's at my feet.
No, it's just you and your squeaky chair today.
Just the squeaky chair. Anyway,
my British accent is awesome. I just need to tell everybody. I'm not going to do it for the crowd, but I'm going to just tell everybody it's awesome.
You're not allowed to tell somebody that and then not do it.
I was going to say, I think if it was truly awesome, you would do it for the crowd, but you know the truth about your accent.
Well, when we put out a blooper reel, eventually, you'll hear me saying the intro in a British accent.
You won't, really. You'll just hear Holly saying it in what she thinks is a British accent.
Yeah, you won't recognize it as such, but it will be to Holly. I'm sure they will wait with bated breath for that episode.
Who wouldn't? I mean, our bloopers are pretty funny, at least to me.
So long as they're funny to you, that's all that matters.
It'll be the funniest. I'll just be crying the whole episode of tears of joy, not tears of sadness. All right, well, let's talk about restaurants.
Should we? Really? Is that what we do here?
Well, we're talking about nostalgia, so we can talk about all sorts of fun things now.
Oh, God.
I like nostalgia.
We know you do, because you're internally like 150 years old.
Yep. Yes, I am. Thank you very much. I have the grace to prove it.
So all of these brands have been talking about nostalgia lately. McDonald's just released an old bucket for Halloween. Very old, from the 90s.
An old bucket. Just the way you frame that. We just put out an old bucket.
It might be important context for our listeners to know that Holly doesn't like Halloween. So if you hear any disdain.
I don't like Halloween. It's true. Burger King's latest ad campaign calls back to nostalgia. Taco Bell just had their marketing campaign where they put two older menu items up against each other. We were talking about it last week on the podcast. Sam was talking about his ad campaign that he remembered. I mean, we were literally bringing up nostalgia as we were the example, the prime example of what that ad campaign was meant to do. So what do you guys think?
Yeah, I mean, like we talked about last week, the restaurant companies, along with the rest of the world, are recognizing that particularly kids of the 90s, like, you know, us, are in a hardcore nostalgia phase right now. Millennials are jonesing for the 90s. And I mean, and maybe Gen Z is too. I don't know. Maybe Gen X is and boomers. Who knows? I guess the 90s were okay. But the Taco Bell ad campaign. Well, I guess the Taco Bell one wasn't totally just 90s because one of the Enchirito was from like the 60s or something. But still, it was harkening back to the times of yore, and it makes a lot of sense. I mean, you know, to use another example, what did I do on Friday night? I watched Hocus Pocus 2 because, duh, I mean, Hocus Pocus 1, every year I watch Hocus Pocus because I'm a child of the 90s. It's not a particularly good movie, but, oh, does it just scratch that itch, you know, that 90s kids need itch. So that was a weird thing to say. But anyway.
well, what did you do during the movie? Do you want to tell people?
What did I do?
Do you
want to
tell people what you did during the movie? Because you told me you fell asleep during the movie.
Oh, I did fall asleep during the movie. Well, but that's the
point. The second one, because the second one was bad. Because I also watched it last week.
Yeah. Well, but see, that's the thing. That's what I'm getting to here, which is that, like, it's not necessarily even the quality of the thing. It's just the nostalgia of the thing that is counting here. Like, I would have watched that thing no matter how bad it looked because I watch Hocus Pocus 1 every year because it takes me back to childhood. So, you know, people will throw money at nostalgic things. They will spend time with nostalgic things and they don't even have to be good because they just want that itch scratched, so to speak.
And some of these nostalgia campaigns are going to bring in like the next generation of consumers, almost millennials, people our age, are going to go to McDonald's to get those boo buckets, are what they're calling them, because of the nostalgia factor. And they're going to bring their kids. Sam's kids are going to end up with boo buckets. And then 30 years from now, they can cycle them back again.
Totally.
It's a never ending cycle. It's like how, you know, fashion and everything cycles every few decades. It's the same kind of thing. And it's bringing in the next the next generation of consumers. It's bringing our generation back and bringing in our hypothetical children.
Or Sam's hypothetical children. Yes, thank you. Holly, are you just waiting for? Do you consider yourself a child of the 2000s, Holly? Are you just waiting for us to get into like 2000s fashion and nostalgia?
I'm a child of the 90s. I was born in the 90s.
But you don't remember the 90s, do you?
I remember some of the 90s.
I feel like you qualify more as a child of the 2000s. I was born in the 80s, but I don't claim the 80s because I barely remember them. Anyway, to your point, Leanne, time will march on and we will start jonesing for the 2000s at some point. And you're right. We're just stuck in this repetitive loop. And the companies are very smart about tapping into that. Now, I'd be curious if nostalgia was much of a thing. I mean, I remember when I was in high school, the 70s were back hardcore, right? And so, which makes sense because that was about 20 years ago. And, you know, then we went through our 80s phase. Hello, Stranger Things. We're in our 90s phase now. For some reason, God knows why, they gave us a Full House reboot, but we were in a 90s phase. It will keep going. And restaurants are playing along with that. It makes sense. It's smart marketing because, again, going back to it, you almost don't even have to try. You don't have to make something good. You can hocus pocus to this thing and just throw meat to the wolves and the wolves will come. You like that? It's pretty good, right?
No.
Meat to the wolves. I don't know. I felt good about it.
Well, so the interesting thing is that McDonald's just brought back these buckets, the Boo buckets. See, I was calling them buckets. That's right. See,
old even buckets. Though it
sounds kind of derogatory.
I think I was taking issue with old, not bucket, because it is very clearly a bucket. But to call it an old bucket, I think was maybe not doing it any favors. A Halloween bucket is very appropriate.
They brought back an old bucket. Made it sound like they had one bucket. That's what I heard when you said it the first time. And I was like, that's not really what's going on here.
And in my head, it was like a beat up wooden bucket with a mop in it. Like when you just say an old bucket.
Yeah.
Same thing. Well, so McDonald's brought back their old bucket versus Burger King took their old idea. Their old ad campaign, and they made it new again. They actually like added new things to it. They made a new song for it. And so for the Have It Your Way, they made it hip hop rap instead of what it was before. So I find that really interesting that they were changing it to make it more modern versus McDonald's just brought back their old buckets. I'm going to keep saying old buckets now because now I can't stop.
Oh boy.
Because now I just can't think of the other word. And so I find it interesting that like the two, I'm curious to see which one works better. I have a feeling McDonald's will actually work better than Burger King's, even though Burger King's is part of the Reclaim the Flame new franchisee reboot that they're doing, that they put all that money into. I have a feeling McDonald's will do much better, and it was a much easier solution for them to do.
Sure. They're really two different things. Like, the Halloween thing, or the McDonald's thing, is a Halloween marketing campaign. Like, the Boo buckets are going to go away in November because it doesn't make sense anymore. So, yeah, it's a fairly easy, inexpensive, I'm putting that in air quotes, thing that McDonald's can do right now to capture nostalgia and consumers in the month of October. The Burger King thing is part of this wider ongoing marketing, like almost complete rebrand that they're working on. So it's a longer range. I think they have different goals. And so in that sense, I think, Holly, you're right that the McDonald's campaign is going to have an immediate impact. You know, I'm sure they're already seeing people show up specifically because they want their buckets. Whereas the Burger King thing, I think has longer range goals that they'll measure by.
Yep.
But even the McDonald's adults Happy Meals are doing the same exact thing. They're aiming to get that nostalgia too, the adult Happy Meals. I mean, I haven't gotten one because there's no McDonald's near me, I don't think. Also, I haven't eaten at McDonald's in a very long time. I'm sure there's a McDonald's
surprised.
Near me. I just don't know where it is.
I was going to say, I'm just surprised you've had McDonald's before. I feel like on this podcast, I keep learning on all the other fast food brands you've never had before. So,
well, I just sampled a very cool food for the first time that you guys will find out about later. Later on in a few weeks, not now.
You're talking about the thing that I was present for, too.
Yeah, Sam was present when I sampled this food for the first time.
I was just trying to determine... the place you, I was trying to determine when you said you guys, whether you were talking to me and Leanne or you guys, like everybody who's listening to this right now.
I say you guys, it's the audience.
Okay. Got it. Yes.
I'm not going to remember that.
You did have a restaurant for the first time and they will all know about it in a few weeks.
Yeah. It was exciting. Right?
It was very exciting.
I've been bragging about it.
Yeah. We're going to have to, that will have to be our good news of the pod in a couple weeks because we could share that as the good news of now, but it would give it away.
It would give it away. Happy it would news. Give away the surprise.
Sorry, happy news. How could I forget that song?
There's
that
a jingle.
Song that,
maybe I'll sing it in British today.
British. You have to now, so.
I wonder how you sing in British.
Well, I'm sure you'll figure it out.
I'll figure it out.
I think you just sing it just the same as you would in American.
But with a British accent. I got to figure out how to get the British accent in there.
Just channel anyway. Adele.
I will channel Adele. Anyways, let's talk about menu price increases.
Let's.
Okay.
So menu prices have increased a lot over the past few months and even year due to inflation. And consumers are starting to react to it. Joanna Fantozzi just wrote a really great piece on NRN about it. So what do you guys think about this? Oh, I do say you guys for the two of you. You're right. You're right. It is confusing. You're right. It is confusing.
Thank you.
We know.
You're right. You're very right. So what do the two of you think about this whole saga of the menu price increases and consumers reacting? I mean, we're going to talk about our consumer reports later, but first let's talk about consumers reacting to menu price increases.
The whole menu price increase thing has been a balancing act for about a year now, right? How do you, as an operator, afford your ingredients and supplies and everything, and also not alienate your consumer base? And so a lot of chains have done multiple small menu price increases. I think Chipotle's raised their prices something like 4 times in the last year, and a lot of chains have done similar strategies, just like increasing them a little bit at a time. What this new data really shows, and Joanna broke down 2 different studies on the topic, and now we're starting to see where that breaking point is for consumers, because consumers understand, like, they're facing inflationary pressures in every area of their lives. And so a reasonable consumer hasn't been upset this year if they go to Chipotle and they have to pay an extra 10 cents for their chicken bowl or whatever. But what we're seeing now, and this is according to Revenue Management Solutions, is that once the menu price has been increased by 10 to 13% is when consumers start dropping off, which as a consumer, I think is reasonable. But of course, as an operator, you're just still playing that balancing act. So that's the kind of data that we're starting to see now, because it's taken us this long to get to the point where some chains have implemented that many menu price increases.
Yeah, and it seems like from these studies, you know, they were singling out the major chains like Burger King, Wendy's, McDonald's, for having significantly increased prices in the 10% range. And it's interesting because when I saw some of the numbers, and, you know, look, I covering this industry for a long time, I think I knew what these numbers were, but to really see on page what their average prices are now, and it's, you know, Burger King's over $8, Wendy's is over $10. I mean, when you throw those numbers around and you think about what is QSR all about? I mean, it's about value. And remember when it was like $5 footlong and the, you know, dollar menu, it used to be that you couldn't go over $5 really in the QSR world because your customers would rebel. And we've gotten up now to $8 to $10 for QSR. Now, of course, inflation, even negating the inflation of the last year or so, those prices should have always been going up because you can't maintain a $4, $5 price point forever with pricing or with inflation constantly happening at some level. But still, it is pretty surprising to see those numbers. And of course, consumers react to that stuff too. Thinking about McDonald's and when, you know, they raise prices on a, you know, quarter pounder by a quarter, they have customers rebel. I think the last year there have been, to Leanne's point, they've been a lot more understanding that, okay, well, that has to happen. But yeah, at some point you've got to stop doing it because they keep noticing that those price increases. Wendy's pointed out in Joanna's story, Wendy's pointed out that they were only increasing according to the consumer index of, but I think that's roughly 6% the inflation, roughly, that prices have increased. So QSR prices in particular seem to be increasing even beyond that. I don't know. I don't know what to make of it all because it's really rocking a hard place. You have to maintain a profit margin. But simultaneously, if you cross that 10 to 13% threshold and start losing customers, well, you've got a bigger problem. And that's where something like a loss leader comes in, where it's like, well, let's take a hit on something because we just got to get customers in the door and look at other ways to get them to spend money to make up for the fact that we're losing money on something because of inflation. So it's an interesting problem. And I think at this point, everybody's probably just holding their breath, hoping that inflation kind of cools off soon. And, you know, we just had a jobs report today. that didn't give a lot more clarity to where inflation goes from here. But the Fed continues to try to cool it off. And, you know, yesterday, OPEC is cutting cutting the production of oil, which means we're all going to see a gas spike again here probably within the next couple of months. So it's a mess. It's a mess. What do you do? And at the end of the day, again, if you have to make money, you've got to increase prices, but you've just got to figure out a way to do so to where customers are not spooked by it.
Well, that's a great segue into our consumer reports survey, which is all about, you know, talking about what consumers are thinking. Leanne, why don't you take it away?
Yeah. So this is our consumer picks report, just in case people are trying to find it on our website. So every year we work with Data Central and do this big report on basically the brands that consumers are most loyal to is the big thing that we look at. And Ron Ruggles did a great breakdown of the full report for our October issue of our magazine. But what I'm doing over the next few weeks is breaking down all the different things that Data Central asks consumers about. So they rank brands based on a variety of factors. And the one I looked at this week was value, because we've been talking about menu prices and increases and all of that. And so I wanted to see which 10 restaurant brands are the ones that consumers think have the best value for the dollar. So that's what I did. this list, it's on our website. It's not a lot of surprises, mostly QSR chains. The top three with the best value, according to consumers, are all pizza brands. But something I think is interesting is that the question that these consumers are asked for this report is, do you think that this brand is best in class for value? So basically, like, do you think this brand has good value? And we say, you know, for example, number one on this list is Little Caesars. 71% of consumers said that Little Caesars are best in class or above average on value. Last year's number one brand had a much higher percentage of consumers ranking them that way. So overall, I think consumers are finding less value, which again, not surprising, but interesting to see that, you know, consumer perception, because we only really look at consumer perception this one time a year. So this is a really interesting time to be looking at it. So we've got a lot of quick service brands, but not all quick service. Golden Corral is on the list. They were on the list last year as well, but mostly QSR, pizza, some burger chains. And that's what we've got. And then I'll be once a week breaking down other things that consumers have ranked these brands on.
Yeah, something that was interesting in the consumer picks overall this year, which you can continue to find out as we dole out this information over the next couple of weeks, is that across the board, a lot of the numbers were lower. So we study attributes, or excuse me, Data Central, our value data partner, they do the studying for us. So they study, we report on multiple characteristics, ambiance, cleanliness, craveability, delivery, takeout, quality service, all of those things, which again, we will have that information up at nrn.com. And across the board, numbers were a little bit lower. And so, and then the big chart that we report on is loyalty. And that is really truly saying, who is your favorite brand that you pick, not because of the convenience of it, but because you're loyal to them. So that's the big one that we report every year. We have the top 50 that we published in NRN this month. You'll see it on the website. And those numbers were lower than normal. So all across the board, Data Central suggested to us that could be a sign that overall impressions of restaurant companies are going down. This is, you know, not a good thing, that the impression of restaurants, the, you know, relationship between the brand and the customer is perhaps souring a little bit. And I just got to tell you, and this is not to, you know, not to point fingers, because everybody listening to this, could, you know, going to sting a little bit, but I don't have a lot of good restaurant experiences anymore. I mean, on the whole, restaurants in general are really struggling on the, like, just broader experience front because of the labor issue, right? And I know enough to say, okay, well, give them a pass because we've got a real labor issue here. But, you know, a lot of people won't give restaurants a pass, unfortunately. And so they if they have that bad experience, for me, it's mostly customer service. I've had a lot of bad customer service experiences in the last several months. And I'm guessing a lot of folks listening probably the same thing, because broadly speaking, when, you know, you're kind of scraping the bottom of the barrel when it comes to labor, that's just a natural reaction. But when you look at our data in the consumer picks, I wonder if that's playing out some in the data here too. And then the last thing I'll say just about the value data in particular, since that's what we're talking about, it did surprise me who wasn't on this list. You know, I don't see Chick-fil-A. Chick-fil-A is across all of the other charts, all the other attributes, Chick-fil-A shows up basically at or near the top, not on the chart for value. A lot of the other standard QSRs are not on here. McDonald's is not on here. Wendy's and Burger King are not on here. Taco Bell is, but then again, lots of pizza brands are. So it's just an interesting thing to look at this data and say, well, what is value then to people? Because if pizza is a big player here and you think of Little Caesars, they're $5 hot and ready. Well, you get a nice big pizza for a nice low price point. So, you know, maybe that truly is what value is. In Golden Corral, it's a buffet. So people pay a price point and they get, you know, all they can eat. So I don't know that there's necessarily, you know, what do you take out of this? What's the actionable information? I think the actionable information here is just to know that the customer's perception of value is changing. They continue to want value. They're clearly finding it in pizza places. And you know, when you see the rest of the data too, you'll know that the broader experience may be suffering, and you have to figure out like which lever to pull, to which attribute you need to sort of improve upon to try to get that customer loyalty back.
Very interesting. Excuse me. Very interesting things to think about when it comes to value and loyalty. And it's an interesting report that we put out every year with Data Central. And it's definitely something that I suggest going through and looking at Leanne's weekly reports that she puts out. It's definitely going to be interesting to see more of the deep dives as we go into it. But definitely read Ron's piece. I'll put it in the show notes so you guys can read up on that. Now it's time for happy news. Oh, wait, British accent. Happy news. Happy news.
You just got
it's
rid of
time
your age.
For happy news.
I know enough Brits to know that they do pronounce their age usually, but sure. I think the dropping of the H is Cockney specifically, but okay, you do you.
Maybe we're talking about appy news as in news about apps.
We're not. We're talking about in-person news. We are talking about a really exciting event that we are having in DC on October 17th for restaurant folks just like you guys listening to this podcast. Sam, why don't you tell our listeners a little bit more about this event and a little bit more about the interview that we have coming up to promote it?
I certainly will, Holly. Thank you for that kind introduction. So we are very excited to be in Washington, D.C., October 17th, 6 to 9 p.m. at Chaya Taco's Chinatown location on I Street. It's going to be a networking reception. It's a free networking reception, free drinks, free food, free conversation. We will also have an educational panel that we're super excited about. This is what we're calling the Create Road Show. And, you know, just a little bit more about that is that we just had Create a couple of weeks ago in Denver. We had a blast, but not everybody can get to Denver, whether they're, you know, preoccupied or they just, you know, cost or whatever it is. And so we want to take Create to the people. We want to, you know, give everybody an opportunity to be able to connect with their peers in the restaurant industry like we were able to do in Denver a couple of weeks ago. And so this is the first of what hopefully will be many of the Create Roadshow series, starting with DC on October 17th. Who can come? If you're an employee of a restaurant company, you are free to join us. You know, we say we're looking really for emerging restaurateurs and independent restaurant operators just because, you know, that's who is just a lot of them in and around downtown DC. But if you're a franchise, if you're a major chain executive, obviously everybody who works for a restaurant company is welcome, because, you know, the best thing about this industry, I've said it before on this podcast, is the community of it. And if you haven't experienced that community, you need to. You need to get out of your bubble. You cannot operate just alone in a bubble, yourself and your company. You need to meet other people doing what you do. And this is an opportunity to do that. So if you are in the DC, Maryland, Virginia area there around the nation's capital, and you have October 17th that evening free, I highly encourage you to join us. Because it will be an awesome opportunity to connect with other people in this industry. I mentioned that we are going to be hosting a panel, and two of the panelists are the guests on this week's podcast, Sahil Rahman and Rahul Vinod, who are the co-founders of Rasa, an Indian fast casual in DC with four locations. They're awesome. They have such a fantastic brand with a ton of potential. They will be sitting on that panel along with Bettina Stern and Suzanne Simon, who are the co-founders of Chaya Tacos. I will be moderating this discussion. We're going to be talking about what it means to scale your business as an emerging concept in particular. There'll be great tips and insights that they're going to be sharing. So all around, highly valuable night. Again, totally free. Just come hang out, meet folks in the industry, learn a little bit, have free drinks, all around a really, really good event. So you will find that invitation also in the show notes. Click on that RSVP. Please come join us. Our whole team, almost our whole team, will be there too. Most of our editors, the three of us here, will be there along with some of our other colleagues. So it's going to be some exciting stuff.
Well, thank you so much for that, Sam. That was so informative and so lovely. Thank you for that.
You're quite welcome.
Well, so now I will toss it over to your interview. Thank you guys so much for joining me today. Stratus Foods is the industry partner you can depend on when you're looking for the very best in fats and oils. Our team of expert researchers, developers, and innovators have helped countless businesses just like yours bring their most delicious menus to life. With products that are reliable, sustainable, and ready to meet any challenge, you can fry, bake, saute, and grill with confidence. Stratus Foods, we've got you covered.
Okay, Sahil and Rahul, thank you guys so much for joining today. As always, appreciate speaking to you guys. Let's talk about the Rasa business. For those who are listening today who are not familiar with your concept, what's the quick synopsis of how you guys started this brand?
Yeah, absolutely. So Rasa, we're an Indian fast casual restaurant based here in the DC area. We've got two locations in DC proper, a couple in Northern Virginia, and looking to open up a couple more in this area. So the quick version on how we got started is, I'm going to try to figure out how to make this quick, because Rahul and I actually, we quite literally grew up in the restaurant industry. So our fathers actually moved to the US from India back in 1985. They had been working in a couple of the top hotels in India back in the day. And when they moved to the U.S., they sort of moved independently the same year, and through the kind of immigrant whisper network, found out that they both were in the States and ended up working at the same Indian restaurant. So our dads worked together for about 6 years at a local spot here before, in 1991, opening up their first restaurant, Bombay Bistro. So, you know, Rahul and I kind of came onto the scene in 1990. That's when we both were born. And yes, so quite literally from the time we were a year old onwards, our fathers were business partners and they owned Indian restaurants together. And so, you know, we really learned to walk inside of Indian restaurants. And with that as part of our childhood, it led to a really unique experience, especially growing up in the U.S., growing up in the public school system, where we were able to witness this massive shift in American perception of both Indian cuisine, but also of Indian culture. So, you know, when we were kids in elementary school, middle school, like today being Indian is kind of cool. Where back in the day, it wasn't the case. You know, I started eating turkey sandwiches as a kid because you'd get picked on for bringing Indian food to school. It was a lot of narratives like The Simpsons from Thank You Come Again to Indiana Jones with the, you know, the spread of monkey brains on the plate and all of this, like, I don't like curry. It's all spicy. It burns twice, once on the way in, once on the way out. And so as kids, we were just a little bit confused because the food that we grew up eating, both in our homes, but also at the restaurants, Rahul's father, Chef Vinod, is an incredible chef. And we were just like, our food is bomb. So not really clear on why our non-Indian friends have all of these perceptions. So, you know, we started bringing them to the restaurant and being like, look, I know you don't think you like Indian food, but why don't you try it? Just tell us what you like. We'll order for you. And uniformly over the course of, you know, 10 or 20 years, we saw people's perceptions shift so dramatically, right? From a place of, oh my God, I really don't want to try this, to, wow, this is my favorite food. You know, to a point where people are coming back for birthdays, graduations, even first dates as we got older. And so what we realized was that the challenge was actually not Indian food, though of course there's some places which have very oily, very spicy, very heavy food. For us, it wasn't the food, it was the way that people were introduced to it. It was that there was a lack of accessibility and a lack of cultural understanding and welcoming to Indian cuisine. So, you know, Rahul and I kind of talked about this idea back when we were in high school, both went to college at the University of Maryland, and when we graduated, we sort of did the good Indian son thing, right? We got like good jobs. So Rahul, you know, started working in investment banking. I was working in strategy consulting. And we both just kind of hated it. It like wasn't the right vibe. It wasn't a good fit. We both grew up with fathers who were entrepreneurs. And so at a certain point, we both were living in New York and started seeing this moment happening where you had brands like Kava kind of busting through. You had a lot of different perceptual shifts in America where people started feeling much more open-minded to new ideas, to new flavors. And so we decided to quit our jobs back in 2014, late 2014. And yeah, we like rented a U-Haul, moved back to our parents' houses. And from there, spent a couple years figuring out how do we get this thing off the ground. You know, I was driving Lyft in the background to support myself. And yeah, about almost 3 years later, we spent a long time figuring out exactly how we wanted to solve this problem. And that kind of emerged as Rasa, which we opened December of 2017. And then from there, you know, it's been a wild ride. Our first couple of years were super fun. We were starting to see a lot of traction and growth. Then, you know, got rocked with the pandemic right as we were about to open restaurants 2 and 3. And feeling really grateful to share that, you know, we've been able to pivot and adapt and weather that storm relatively well, despite a lot of chaos and challenge. Don't want to make it seem like it was easy. Sure. I think that'd be a quite a lie. But yeah, you know, through that process, we managed to stay true to our vision, stay true to what we were trying to build. And now just raised our Series A. We opened up our fourth restaurant, our first suburban restaurant, and really excited to continue doing what we do.
Rahul, I remember a couple of weeks ago you were telling me that in that process, I think it sounded like Sahil was more convinced that this could work. You were a little bit less so, that Sahil had to do some convincing of you. What was it that finally convinced you that this business model could be successful?
Sure. Yeah. So, you know, like at the time when we both lived in New York City, actually, Sahil and I would meet up on a weekly basis. And kind of just hang out and like talk about this idea for an Indian fast casual, who is out there currently in not only just the Indian market, but even just overall fast casual market. And if we were ready to kind of take that leap of entrepreneurship, you know, I think I had been more risk adverse for a lot of my life and was like, oh my God, this seems like crazy to leave a high paying job to go try to start a restaurant. A lot of people always talk about how restaurants fail and they're really hard to run. We've also seen it firsthand with our dads, just like growing up, you know, my dad would get home at 3 a.m. every single night kind of thing. And so we spent a good number of months just debating if this was the right move for us. And when it really came down to it, it was, you know, what's the worst thing that's actually going to happen? And, you know, we were lucky at the time that we have families who are supportive to us. So, and we don't have any, you know, true responsibilities in the sense that we didn't have homes that that we owned, or you know, families to support, and things like that. So we viewed it as, look, this is something that we've talked about for a long time. We see this as the fast casual format, as the best way to kind of increase the accessibility of Indian food in the most effective way. Let's go out and let's try this, because I think we'll always regret not giving it a shot, given the food quality that we've grown up with and that we know we have. And what's the worst thing that's actually going to happen? And when we really talked about what's the worst thing that's going to happen, we're like, all right, we're going to try this out. We're going to do it for, you know, 3-5 years. If it fails, okay, we've learned a lot, but you know, we're lucky that we'd be able to move back into our parents' houses and then start again, and you know, and just learn a ton from that experience. And so when we kind of shifted our mindset into that, instead of a place of fear, but a place of opportunity, I think that's what really kind of led us to be like, you know what, like, let's pack our stuff up, let's quit our jobs, and let's do this.
All right, so going back, Sahil, to what you were mentioning about sort of the perception of Indian food when you guys were young, certainly come a long way, thankfully, but you guys didn't open an Indian restaurant that like your dads were running. You guys did adapt the model. Tell me about the process of adapting to the modern American tastes and understanding of fast casual without losing the authenticity of Indian cuisine.
Yeah, for sure. It's a big question. And when I think about it, it felt like we really started with the problem, right? The question was, why aren't people eating Indian food more, right? And what we actually found was sort of a little bit directionally different. We realized that more people were eating Indian food than we realized, and more people liked it than we realized. What we found was that there was just a lack of frequency. You know, Indian food had come a long way. It was almost like our perceptions needed an update button, where people really like Indian food, especially in urban areas. And what we realized was the challenge for a lot of folks was that they were only eating it once or twice a year. And the reason was it was often in random shopping centers that you had to get to. Once you got there, it wasn't a very inviting storefront. You walk inside and it starts to feel a little bit foreign, right? And you've got white tablecloths, you've got sitar music playing, a Taj Mahal paintings on the wall, whatever it is. And so environmentally, you're already feeling a little bit out of your comfort zone, which isn't a bad thing. But then you get this menu, and now it's got 1,000 items you can't pronounce. You're totally overwhelmed. You've got a Indian guy with a mustache serving you. And, you know, both our dads are Indian guys with mustaches, so, you know, no shade, right? But what it ends up resulting in is this experience that can feel a little bit overwhelming for people. And so they end up just ordering the same three items, right? You get your butter chicken, you get your garlic naan, your saag paneer, and your samosa, right? And there's nothing wrong with that, but there's so much more in the culture and in the cuisine. And what we found was that people were really liking Indian food, but they'd only go with their Indian friend. And so when we started to look at that, we started to think about, how do we deconstruct this problem? How do we remove all of these barriers to entry for Indian food? How do we really make this an experience that's super welcoming for people? How do we become the front door for both Indian culture and Indian cuisine? And so what that looked like was literally starting with the front door. You know, we took a research trip to India and we're just taken by these Rajasthani doors. So we actually had a beautiful Indian door custom built in New Delhi, and it was shipped all the way from Delhi to DC to literally welcome people in with this front door. And we set up a big opening window and had a beautiful storefront with swings inside, because we both grew up with swings in our childhood homes. And then when you walk inside the space, we sort of wanted to have it be this space that felt really interesting and really cool. But also, if you're South Asian, you can kind of see yourself in it, and you can kind of notice some things that somebody else might not. So we've got boxes in the wall which are filled with cool Indian antiques and trinkets from our travels. And we've also got strings that are sort of flowing across the space to represent the movement of India. So it sort of started for us from location. Let's be in a main spot. Then it was like, all right, they see you. Now, what do they feel when they see you? So let's make a beautiful storefront that feels welcoming and kind of curiosity invoking. And then once you walk inside and you start going down the line, we want to make it as familiar and comfortable for you as possible. So we're going to maintain the authenticity of the flavors that we grew up with. But at the same time, instead of calling it bangun, we're going to call it eggplant, right? Instead of chole, we'll call it chickpeas, right? And so if you are new to Indian culture, Indian cuisine, you walk down, you think, oh, this is a cool spot. You understand that it's a fast casual, similar to brands that you know, like a Cava or Chipotle or Sweetgreen or whatever that looks like. And you're seeing ingredient names that you're familiar with. So we're packaging it in a way that doesn't necessarily scare someone away, especially someone who might have preconceived notions about Indian cuisine or ethnic food or foreign food or whatever that might look like, and allow them to taste it with an open mind. And then from that place, form an opinion and form a judgment. So that was kind of how we started thinking about how do we take the flavors that we grew up with and welcome it to people in a new way.
Mm-hmm. So going back to then to the pandemic, of course, was difficult, as it was for everybody. You said you were about to open units number 2 and 3 and had put those on the shelf for a little while because in the early days of the pandemic, because of everything. What was it that ended up getting you guys through the 2 years following March of 2020? Why do you guys think you were able to survive where so many other startup brands in an independent restaurants were not able to?
Sure, yeah. So I can start, and then Sahil, you can feel free to like jump in. So I think, you know, it wasn't one singular thing. I think it was a handful of kind of scrappy things that we did over the course of the, you know, the past 2 and 2.5 years that helped us kind of see through to the other side. And so from the beginning, when we started Rasa, you know, we wanted to be a part of the community that our restaurant was in. And we always wanted to help uplift others in the community. And so as soon as the pandemic hit, we immediately saw schools closing, you know, and, you know, a lot of kids go to these schools so that they get their daily meal. And so almost immediately, Sahil and I were like, well, what happens to all those kids who rely on their schools for the only food that they actually get in the entire day? And then at the same time, you also saw all these nurses and doctors who were, you know, working crazy overtime hours to be at the hospital away from their families. And so we said, you know what, like, how can we help in this moment of like need in the entire country? And the one thing which we know how to do is cook food. So we said, okay, if you are a hospital worker, medical worker, doctor, you know, if you're a school children, if you work at a school, feel free to come to any Rasa. We're going to give you a free meal. And so we just started doing that kind of off the bat. And we were like, look, we'll figure out how to pay for these meals and for this food cost and stuff at a later point, but let's just start with this. And it was pretty cool to see that a lot of people in our community reach out to us and said, hey, we love what you guys are doing. How can we help support you? And so that actually allowed us to think a little bit bigger. And we said, hey, you know what, let's maybe actually do our own fundraiser. And we called it Feed the District. And we partnered with one of our investors, Vernon Davis, formerly of the Washington Commanders, I guess, or Redskins. And so we basically were able to raise over $50,000 to help feed a number of different communities in need. And kind of parallel to that, as we were getting this program started, we're pretty close with Jose Andres and World Central Kitchen. And so we had built out our second restaurant and it was fully built and we were unable to open because the health department said, hey, we're not giving any new opening inspections right now. And so we reached out to them and said, hey, guys, I know you guys are constantly on the ground. You know where the need is and providing meals. Do you want to use our extra kitchen? Do you want us to prepare meals out of this second restaurant? And it was kind of great timing because they were like, look, like we're thinking about starting this program called Restaurants for America. Restaurants are hurting because people are locked up in their homes. And at the same time, the like need for food is greater than ever. Will you guys, you know, be the one of the pilot restaurants in the entire country to run that program? And so almost immediately we signed up with them. And the very next day, you know, Nate, the former CEO of World Central Kitchen, was like, can you make 400 meals for us by 11 a.m.? And we're like, all right, let's do it. And, you know, it was a really kind of whirlwind experience because they were kind of building that platform as, you know, it's as if you're building a plane while you're flying it. And we were just calling Uber XL drivers to take the meals to different, you know, halfway houses or schools or hospitals. And we were just giving them tip to, because they were expecting to pick up people. And we were walking outside of our restaurant with like 6 U-Haul boxes full of food. So, you know, that kind of program went on, throughout the year, and we continued to like find ways to partner with other nonprofits who were looking for, you know, high quality, healthful meals that were needed in the community. And then as we took a more like broader look, we're like, look, people are not in the cities right now where, our only location at the time that was open. And so how do we get the food out to where people are? And, you know, I'm not sure exactly where we got the idea. We saw some other local restaurant owners and some friends in the industry doing the same thing. But we started neighborhood drops in the suburbs of D.C. where we basically say, okay, hey, Silver Spring, we're going to come to your neighborhood. We're going to bring it quite literally inside your neighborhood. Here's a ordering link, an order from us, and we'll bring it there for free. And we started doing that pretty often. There was a point where we're doing 2-3 times per week, and that really helped because the population in DC historically really swells during the week as you have the federal government and all the contractors and everything. And it was a ghost town here. Mm-hmm. And so instead of just trying to wait around for the guests to come to the restaurant or hope that people order on Uber Eats, we thought, how can we bring the food to where people actually are, which was in their homes in the suburbs. Mm-hmm.
Does that help then as you guys move into the suburbs? Your first location was Navy Yard, right? And I imagine, mm-hmm. I mean, that's an easy sell because that's where a lot of younger folks, more open-minded eaters are around there. Going out to the suburbs, you know, it's obviously much wider demographic in the suburbs. So that work going into the suburbs, doing those drops, tell me about that. I mean, how has this brand translated from urban environment in DC to the suburban environment?
Yeah, it's a great question. So it's been great so far. You know, we just opened up our first restaurant that's truly in the suburbs out in Fairfax in a large town center called Mosaic. And, you know, what's actually been quite striking to me is the true diversity in the Virginia and Maryland suburbs. I mean, we grew up here, Gaithersburg, Maryland, oddly enough, it's our hometown, was named more diverse than Queens, which is like hard for us to believe.
Yeah.
But, you know, I think, you know, I shouldn't speak for all, but I think we both had this narrative that DC is like super diverse, which it is. But getting out to Fairfax, it's been actually quite shocking that it almost seems more diverse out in that market. And so, you know, we had seen during the pandemic that a lot of brands which had urban and suburban locations, that their suburban locations were outperforming. So when we had recently raised this round of funding, we very consciously chose to move out to the suburbs. And we were feeling excited about it for a couple of reasons. One, because there's nothing like what we're doing that exists today in those places. And two, because we had actually been 50-50 lunch dinner before the pandemic, which we felt was going to bode really well for that consumer base. And so for us, it's actually been a pretty smooth transition. There's certainly been things we needed to adapt, like, you know, you need more high chairs. We had to launch a kids menu. There's all sorts of we had to kid proof the restaurant in some senses. Like, we've got the swings and we've had them tied down to the ground so people can't like swing like crazy in the space. And in the first 3 days, all three swings broke.
That doesn't surprise me. My kids would have not been the ones breaking those swings.
Right. We're like, these kids are animals. And so it's been fun. It's had us rethinking our store footprints. We've noticed that people tend to dine in much more in this particular market. So it's starting to have us wonder if we need to have larger restaurants because our restaurants are running out of seats and things like that. So yeah, it's been a bit of a whirlwind, but a really exciting one to start opening in new markets.
Tell me about the operational evolution of this brand too. Cause I mean, obviously the last couple of years, there's been any number of new platforms, new technologies, new services that you can look at now for, you know, serving Rasa food to customers. But I mean, also to your point, Sahil, about the footprint. I mean, I think a lot of operators are rethinking what the restaurant looks like today. So for you guys, operationally speaking, what has the evolution been like? Do you feel like from when you opened store number one to now store number four, does it feel like things have changed much? I'll take that as a yes. The smiles on their faces.
Rahul, I'll let you, my short answer is 1,000%, but I'll let Rahul provide a bit more color.
Sure.
Yeah. So, I mean, you know, things have, progressed a lot for us from our first restaurant to now, with like four restaurants, you know, just from every aspect of the business. You know, I'll be honest that when we first opened our first location on the first week, we didn't have any recipes written down, mm-hmm. let alone like recipe card. And so we have come a long way since then in trying to streamline that. But in terms of kind of going through this COVID and environment, the increase of pickup and delivery, you know, we've seen ensuring that our kitchens are kind of built for that type of scale. So similar to what you'll see in a number of other brands, really trying to make sure it's really clear where the online order or delivery pickup area is. And you'll see a like pretty clear transition from our Navy Yard store, which is the first one, which, you know, we had maybe one shelf on the side, and not a clear designated area, versus now at Mosaic, which is our fourth location, we have this kind of dedicated pickup area. And then even for the production of the meals, making sure there's almost a second back line for both hot and cold food, so that kind of operation doesn't affect the in-house customer who is coming into the restaurant, and the like team is still able to execute on the online orders at a quick pace. And then we've also continued to kind of lean into cooking technology where we can, and how can we be more efficient in cooking our products as we go. And, you know, I think from when we first opened and we had, you know, a flat top, a Marafoni pizza oven, we had stockpot burners, a range, we've really tried to lean into some of the newer technology like combi ovens, which can further just reduce your cooking line and are multifaceted in that, you know, you can bake something, grill it, steam it, you know, whatever it may be, and has really allowed us to make our kitchen and cooking operation a bit more efficient and seamless.
Anything, Sahil, for you that you've seen as being the primary evolutions of this brand?
Yeah, I mean, it feels like we've had multiple death and rebirth cycles operationally. You know, when we first started, like literally the first week, Rahul's dad and the chef from our dad's restaurant was in the kitchen, like doing super small batches. You know, we had my aunt rolling out naans. Like it was just total chaos. My little sister was doing dishes and my dad was on cash. You know, it was almost like a sitcom. And so it's really neat to be sitting here today and thinking about all of the steps that we've taken from that point to today, all of the learnings, what's working, what's not, what scales, what does not, how do we ensure consistency, how do we ensure food quality, but also food safety. And so it's when I say 1,000%, I really feel like it has changed 10 times over. And I mean, even what Rahul was talking about before, we needed a 15-foot hood and now we need a 6-foot hood. And so it really feels as though in every aspect of the operations and of just the whole business, you know, whether that's from the back end with the finances and the bookkeeping or inventory software or whatever that might be, it really feels like everything's evolved. And what's interesting is it feels like when you go from one restaurant to three or four restaurants, there's sort of this quantum leap that happens. And we've kind of been in that transition. But what's really neat as we look to grow further is we're sort of still in this transition from this 1 to 5, but at the same time, it's kind of like the doors of perception have been opened further and they continue to open. Honestly, the NRN conference was huge. Like, we're talking about cooking technology, meeting people who are introducing all sorts of new technologies, both from an environmental conscious standpoint, but also thinking about cost effectiveness and performance. It really feels like now we're starting to think about this whole new world of this 5 to 15 growth, right? And in that, also thinking about how our operations will continue to evolve. So while ops are stressful and chaotic and messy, it's really neat to be able to not only look back at how far we've come, but also at this size, starting to see all of these different doors and avenues that are opening up to us with a lot of different potential partners.
Yeah. So you're raising capital now. You're looking to grow. In this scaling process, what do you feel about the Rasa positioning and how you hope to position this brand? Because, you know, of course, we've come a long way in terms of palate and just Americans' willingness to try new foods. But, you know, we're still getting to a point now where, I mean, it wasn't so long ago we were calling all global foods ethnic foods, you know, and, you know, so you go from that to global foods to, I mean, Indian fast casual. I mean, how do you try to position this brand when you go out into new markets where maybe it's not so diverse as the DC market is?
Mm-hmm. I've got a lot of thoughts, but Rahul, do you want to start and then I can kind of jump in?
Sure. Yeah. So, I think the like kind of main underlying fundamental is that we've been trying to create a really strong, healthful, tasty, fast casual brand that happens to serve Indian food in a certain sense. And, you know, I think it's been really cool to see throughout the like past few years of people will come into Rasa, not know that it's Indian food, order a bowl, try it, and then later come up to one of us or the GM and be like, hey, this is really good. What kind of food is it? And they're surprised or, you know, shocked that it's Indian food because they didn't think that they liked it. And so we're trying to kind of straddle this line of if you are Indian or you are looking for those flavors, you are satisfied. But at the same time, we want to be able to compete with the other fast casual brands, you know, that we look up to, whether it's a Cava, Sweetgreen, you know, Chipotle in like that sense as well.
Sahil, what are your thoughts?
Yeah, I would totally build on it, of what Rahul's saying. I think we have this opportunity of, you know, of course we view Indian food as one of the fastest growing categories in the country. We're seeing the growth in Indian CPG in the grocery stores. We're seeing the rise of Indian restaurants and Indian cultural permeation throughout the U.S. So I think there's sort of natural tailwinds that are lifting up this category. And, you know, we think there's space for a lot of different brands in this area. And we absolutely want to be one of the winners, right? We definitely want to be one of the leading Indian fast casual brands in the country. But we don't want to limit ourselves just to the Indian fast casual category, as Rahul was saying. We just want to be one of the best restaurants in America, period. Right? We want to be one of the best fast casuals. And when people think about food that feels good and tastes good, you know, from our perspective, it feels like everyone's trying to do it, but it doesn't feel like many have actually done it well, which still surprises me. And so we really want to be a place that shows that you can have food that has a lot of flavor, that's got punch, that's got flair, that you can eat multiple times a week that feels great for you. And so I think we want to play in that lane. And to Rahul's point, I think we've got a really exciting opportunity to be a bit of a bridge, right? Like, we are American and we are Indian. We were born here, but our families are Indian, right? And so we've got this opportunity to be a cultural bridge, you know, as Rahul mentioned, for South Asians to feel seen and also to introduce non-Indians or non-South Asians to our culture and our cuisine. But more broadly, I think we're thinking a lot about how might we use food as this vehicle for cultural change? How might we use food as this gateway drug, really, to introduce people to whole new worlds, right? Like, only 30-35% of Americans have passports. How might we push people to think more globally? How might we push people to be more understanding, to be more curious, to be more open-minded? And I think that with what we're doing here with Rasa, we have a really grand opportunity that we hope to lean into to spark conversation and bring, you know, one person at a time, this country a little bit closer together.
What are the biggest obstacles that you would say stand in your way of accomplishing all of that?
How much time you got?
Very, very briefly. I mean, outside the, I'm sure you guys are dealing with labor just like anybody else. I'm sure you're dealing with real estate. Is perception still your biggest challenge, or is it more operational challenges that you guys are facing these days?
Yeah, this is something that feels really alive for us right now. So Rahul, I'll let you start, and I'll kind of chime in as well.
Yeah, you know, I think it's honestly a bit of both. I think it's because we opened two restaurants in the heart of the pandemic, and then a third restaurant just, you know, like few months ago, there's still a little bit of awareness which we were trying to gain. And even in parts of DC where we have operated for over 2 years, people are just coming back to the office or just moving back into the city, and they haven't heard of us. And so I think, you know, that's part of the battle which we're seeing right now, is just how do we just drive awareness to our stores as people kind of enter this pseudo post-COVID new normal, or maybe now they're coming into the office twice a week or three times a week. And so I think there's that aspect. And then operationally, you know, we've quickly gone from one store to four stores over a short period of time. And because of COVID, we didn't necessarily feel the strain of that growth until now, where we are getting busier at all four locations. And now it is putting, you know, the like need for us to put in a bit more structure, for sure. So sorry, we're trying to actively, you know, balance, how do we create more structure for our teams, for our staff, and also for our supply chain. When we had one store, you know, it was easy for us to be scrappy. And, if we were out of a certain spice, we knew which Indian store to go buy it from and things like that. And now, how do we partner with some of our vendors and try to consolidate them to make the entire process just much more simpler for our teams, and also more scalable for growth? So those are all the, you know, kind of things that we're facing right now.
Yeah, and I would sort of I would agree with Rahul, and I sort of see it from a similar and directionally different standpoint. Of to me, it's the question of how do you scale the magic in some senses. Of how do you, like, when Rahul and I were in the restaurant every day talking to every guest, you know, spending time with each team member, we call our team the squad. So like there's an inherent closeness there, right? There's a inherent ability for us to be able to connect with our guests in a unique way because of our backgrounds, right? And so there's a really exciting and challenging question of, you know, inherently you're going to have the problems of ops get harder as you grow, things become more complex, right? You've got to make sure your food safety is there, that you're able to produce for all of your restaurants, that you've got people on the line, things are staffed, so on and so forth. But those to me are like table stakes. You've got to do it if you're scaling. But for this to be truly, truly successful and impactful, and to achieve this vision and potential that we feel the brand has, it feels like a really grand question in how do we take the things that are in our minds that, you know, we feel are really true? How do we take the things that our team is passionate about and really suss out that core vision, those core values, and be able to bring that not only at the restaurants that we're standing in, but at every restaurant we open? How do we grow quickly, you know, and continue to introduce our food to more people, but at the same time, how do we do it in a way that's really thoughtful so that we can be pioneers opposed to just recreating the wheel that that a lot of other fast casuals have done, right? So I think there's the challenge I see is really scaling this magic, staying true to the vision, and also this question of, you know, how might we continue to be innovative and push beyond what we're seeing today? And how might we, in this process of the chaos and complexity of scaling, not lose that desire to keep pushing the ball forward.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's exciting to watch. Sahal and Rahul, I appreciate your guys' time today and looking forward to talking more about this. In fact, on October 17th, we're looking forward to hosting our Create Roadshow in Washington, D.C. at Chaya Taco's Chinatown location. October 17th, 6 to 9 p.m. You guys will be there. Suzanne Simon and Bettina Stern, co-founders of Chaya, will be there. We'll be talking all about this. So looking forward to keeping the conversation going there. Guys, thanks a lot.
Thanks, Sam.
Likewise.
See you soon.
Thanks, Sam.